I'm going to read the course, the class description to kind of give a little clarified context of what I'm going to talk about. Throughout its history, the church's leaders have encouraged members to uphold the Constitution as a method of preserving our liberty. Numerous quotes attest to the importance of this, and the council is correct. However, there are many prerequisites to being an effective champion of the Constitution, and many Latter-day Saints embrace policies, philosophies, and practices which invalidate their public efforts to raise this important banner. Let's learn why good government begins with you, and why one's effort to promote freedom is incomplete if it's not first balanced by personal responsibility. So, in effect, what I'm saying is, set aside the Constitution, ignore the federal government, let's talk about something more fundamental. So to start, I want to read to you a few of the many oppressive laws that are on the books as context for what we'll then follow with. And I had 8 pages of notes last time in a 1-hour class, and I ended with like 20 minutes to spare. I have 5 pages of notes this time, so maybe I'll be more long-winded, or maybe we'll just have some Q&A, which was really great last time. Okay, examples of bad laws. A new car dealership can't set up shop within a certain number of miles of an existing car dealership. All car dealerships are required to be closed on Sunday. A person who owns his own flag, private property, cannot publicly burn it. Bath salts These are laws that are on the books today. Bath salts are banned. Certain restaurants wishing to sell alcohol must mix their customers' drinks behind a visual barrier. Individuals may not collect more than 200 gallons of rainwater on their property. A dairy farmer may not sell his cow's natural milk to a consenting adult who wants to drink it raw. On top of paying for your own kids' education, or their own kids' education, parents who homeschool or who enroll their children in private school have to also pay for the education of others' children through their income tax. Fornication, not a word you'll probably hear in any other class here today, fornication is a Class B misdemeanor, punished if prosecuted by up to 6 months in jail and $1,000 in fines. Gas stations may not sell their product below cost. The contents of dishwashing detergent are regulated by law to prohibit phosphates, one of the most effective substances in actually cleaning the dishes. And the last one I'll share today, prosecutors can obtain all sorts of information about an individual without a warrant using something called an administrative subpoena. It's kind of like the NSA. So if you're at all involved in politics, you might know what I'm about to say, but none of those laws are federal laws. Those are all state laws. In fact, those are all Utah laws. And I could go on. In fact, I'd probably bore you with just focusing on that. What do you mean?
Like a federal government now has...
So that's not to say...
anything we do in any way.
Correct. So that's not to say that the federal government can't or wouldn't or doesn't do any of these things. But these are all Utah laws. Similar laws, worse laws, exist in states throughout the country. So why is this significant? I think it's significant because too often we focus on the Constitution. And that's not a bad thing. Constitution's a good thing. But when we focus primarily and heavily on the Constitution, too often, we as Latter-day Saints, we as Utahns, we as Americans, we as individuals, neglect things that are closer to home, upon which we can have a greater impact. And I think it's hard for people, in fact, I think it makes sense why, you know, you'll see a candidate wave their Constitution, and this is important, we need to, you know, legislate based on the Constitution. That's all great. But this is too easy. Why? It's because it looks like this. It's something you can hold and read. It's a benchmark, right? It's really easy to get mad at the federal government when you can read this and say, well, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2 says that you can't do X, Y, and Z, and you're doing it. Therefore, stop doing it and let us have the power back, right? It's really easy when you have a benchmark to say, federal government should not be doing this, therefore, you know, whatever your therefore is, stop doing it. What's the benchmark for Utah? Is there one?
I think we put the religion on the benchmark, and so that we create laws and then take away certain, I don't know, liberties, you know?
Because it's easy, right, to point to a constitution and say, here's a benchmark, here's what the federal government, you can only do these things. They're enumerated powers. In fact, Federalist 45, anyone read the Federalist Papers? Federalist Papers, James Madison, and number 45, this was a collection of articles that were written to advocate for ratification of the Constitution, okay, by three of the founders. And in this one, James Madison said this, you may have heard of this quote, "The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution," remember it hadn't yet been ratified at that time, "the powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite." Okay? Powers delegated to the federal government are few and defined. Again, we have this benchmark. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite. Unfortunately, this, among other arguments like it, have led to a gross misunderstanding, which I'll now explain. The prevailing view is that in absence of a specifically enumerated and delegated power to the federal government, the states enjoy that power. That's it. For example, let's say the federal government can't ban people with a red, pink, kind of a pink tie. Okay, federal government has not been delegated authority to have anything to do with someone that has a pink tie. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that. They don't have the power, in theory. Of course, in practice, they take whatever power they want. Benchmark be darned. So the federal government doesn't have the authority to legislate because they don't have a delegated authority written in the Constitution that has anything to do with a pink tie. The misconception that many people have is that, oh, well, because the federal government lacks any authority to have anything to do with a pink tie, therefore what? Who does? The states. Okay, therefore it falls to the states. The states are kind of the backstop. They're the default. False. Horribly false. That is a big, big government idea. What that's called in legal terms is plenary power. I'll write it on the board so you can see. And you can go Google it and see how many people have written how much stuff about plenary power. Plenary basically means absolute, right? These folks have the power. Whoever has plenary power is the authority, is the person. And what happens is you get many people who support the Constitution who then take this line of thinking and say, well, because the federal government can't do something, therefore the states can and retain that power. Okay, so...
I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
Because when you say that, you're so definite with that. But we have a federal government right now that looks right beyond that Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even hold to it.
Yeah. I'll explain to that in a second, because that's a good point. This is from a book written about state constitutions. It's written by a constitutional law professor, which in these days doesn't mean much because some guy named Obama, in theory, was once a constitutional law professor, and we see how that's gone. But this was written about state constitutions, and it's written in this paragraph that I'm going to read about plenary power. And it's talking about the benchmark, okay? It says, the state legislative branch is distinctive in comparison with the federal legislative branch, right? So we're talking about our state legislatures versus Congress. It's distinctive in that the federal constitution is an instrument of grant, a document that expressly delegates powers to the federal government. Whereas, as this guy says, state constitutions, in terms of basic theory, are instruments of limitation. Thus, the state government, having plenary powers, this guy says, need not look to the state constitution for any specific grant of powers, but must rather look to it for any limitations it may impose on the state's plenary power. And I'll summarize this if it's confusing. This, he continues a little bit more, this basic theory of state constitutional law, namely that state governments have plenary powers, and that in consequence any provision included in the constitution will operate as a limitation on its powers, is not uncontroversial. Which, if you get rid of the double negatives, it is controversial. And I'm going to explain why. What he's effectively saying is that those who argue for plenary power, which is most of the people who support the Constitution and say the states' rights, states don't have rights. Okay? We'll get into that in a minute. But most of the people who support these arguments believe that this U.S. Constitution delegated certain powers to the federal government, and it did. But they wrongly believe that states enjoy plenary power and that, for example, the Utah Constitution is only an instrument of limitation. What that means is state of Utah can do anything it wants unless the Utah Constitution says it can't, right? So the theory is that the federal government can't do anything unless it's in here, but Utah government can do whatever the heck it wants as long as, you know, pretending this is the Utah Constitution, as long as it's not prohibited from doing so. Does that make sense, kind of what this argument is about? This may sound a little bit too legal and dry, but you're going to see really quick why this is important. So is this true? Are states all powerful? Are they only limited by their constitution?
Can we use an example that we would all know? I want to know what you think about this. So Arizona wanted, they came up with a law or regulation or whatever to handle their immigration problem, which was really what the federal government, as I understand, I have never read it, but I understand it was really what the federal government says we should do.
Okay.
And they just, the Supreme Court just voted that down.
Right.
So
here's my answer.
Okay, so now tell me.
A few minutes ago, you bought this book, right? There's a whole chapter in immigration on it, which answers exactly that. And I'll get into specifics in a minute. But this carries kind of a train of thought that I want to continue on for a minute. Otherwise,
I'm not saying one's right and one's wrong. I just want to know how that fits.
One is right and one is wrong. Okay, so are states all powerful? Are they only limited by their own constitutions? Well, let's read the 10th Amendment, if I can find it in my handy-dandy Constitution here. All right. 10th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution says, "The powers not delegated to the United States by this Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are what?" Does anyone know? Anyone familiar with the 10th Amendment? Are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. Okay? This is something highly overlooked. It's overlooked by people who argue for plenary power. The powers not delegated to the federal government are reserved to the states, sure, or the backstop, the ultimate backstop in all this, the people. And that's something we overlook, and that's why the plenary power is wrong, which I'm going to explain. Mental exercise. Tomorrow, government is gone. Every level of government, your city council, your state government, federal government, it's all gone. I don't know how. Be creative with your imagination. Government's gone. We don't want that, right? I mean, we want to be able to associate with one another and have some form of government to secure our rights. And, you know, we want some security. So let's say we decide to form a government. How do we empower that government? Well, we empower that government with the rights that we have as individuals, right? The government that we create cannot exceed the power of the creators. We can't delegate to the government powers we don't have. If I can't punch my neighbor in the face, right, without repercussions, I'm not morally justified in doing that, I can't empower my government to do that on my behalf. A government that operates with the consent of the governed and their delegated authority can only have the powers that they have. This is not radical, even if it sounds new to you, and I hope it doesn't, but if it does, that's all right. John Locke, you're probably all familiar with him, right? British jurist, political theorist. Thomas Jefferson, among others, relied heavily on his stuff. This is what he says, and this gets to this example that we're thinking about right now. Imagine government is gone. Well, what kind of authority can we empower a new government with, and what does it have to do with states' rights, with plenary power? This is what John Locke says. "To properly understand political power and trace its origins, we must consider the state that all people are in naturally," right, before government. Government's gone. "That is a state of perfect freedom of acting and disposing of their own possessions and persons as they think fit within the bounds of the laws of nature. People in this state do not have to ask permission to act or depend on the will of others to arrange matters on their behalf. The natural state is also one of equality, in which all power and jurisdiction is reciprocal, and no one has more than another. It is evident that all human beings, as creatures belonging to the same species and rank, and born indiscriminately with all the same natural advantages and faculties, are equal amongst themselves. They have no relationship of subordination or subjection, unless God had clearly set one person above another and conferred on him an undoubted right to dominion and sovereignty. So what does that mean? That means in this mental exercise we're doing, that imagine government is gone, we're in a state of nature, we're in our natural relationship of equality, there's no political elite class, there's no serfs, there's nothing, we're all human beings. Well, what powers do we have? If we're going to create a government, what can we do? The Declaration of Independence states that governments are justly instituted to secure the rights of those creating it, quote, deriving their just powers from this consent of the governed. And it doesn't say the federal government. Okay, government in general can only be authorized by the consent of the governed with their powers. As government is not an eternally existing entity, meaning, you know, governments come and go, the Declaration of Independence says that we can alter or abolish government. U.S. government hasn't existed. Utah's government hasn't existed forever. The question of what authority such an organization may morally and justly possess must be addressed at this fundamental and underlying level before we talk about anything else. So what am I saying there? That means before we talk about getting upset about what Congress is doing and saying it's not in the Constitution, do we really even understand what government is? Government isn't what our social studies teacher said it is. Government isn't what Glenn Beck sometimes says, you know. There are very fundamental things here that John Locke and others are talking about that we need to understand. Okay, so how do I want to take this next? The creation of government, which really is an entity to defend our rights and enforce each person's individual and inherent rights, cannot exceed its creator. This institution may only be morally empowered with authority that its various members themselves possess. In all questions of government authority, in this matters for federal government, for city government, for any government, it is insufficient to superficially check the action against the limits of the man-made laws that govern. So what does that mean? That means, okay, well, if a law is unconstitutional, or even if a law is constitutional, right, it would be constitutional to declare war against Mexico tomorrow because of the drug cartels. But is that right? It would be constitutional to prohibit all people from with the last name Boyack from becoming a U.S. citizen because the rights of naturalization are conferred and delegated to the federal government. But does that make it right? Just because something passes constitutional muster and our little benchmark here, is it right? Does it pass these fundamental and underlying principles? Well, what does that even mean? That means anything that the government does is illegitimate unless you or I as individuals can do that to one another and can therefore delegate to government the power to do it on our behalf to this random other guy. Okay? Ezra Taft Benson gave an address once called The Proper Role of Government. Has anyone read it or even heard of it? I got some nods. Okay. You can Google it. If you Google it, there's some that are excerpts out there or an abridged version, so look for the original. I don't think so. It was originally a John Birch Society kind of lecture, and then he published it in a couple books. I don't think it was ever in conference.
What's the title of it?
The Proper Role of Government.
Was it when he was prophet or...
No, apostle.
No,
it was when he was in the 12.
No, it was when he was U.S. agriculture.
But he was apostle.
He was an apostle at the time. As that as well. The Proper Role of Government. So read it. It's very interesting and insightful. He talks about a lot of this stuff. What's the proper role of government? Okay, these are the fundamental principles we need to articulate and understand before we start getting very specific and saying Article 1, Section 2, or whatever. We need to understand these underlying principles. In there, he has a line that is supremely important that many people who I know who have read it gloss over. And I'm going to read it now because it's the basis of what we'll be talking about after that. He says this: the proper function of government is limited only to the spheres of activity within which the individual citizen has the right to act. I'll read it again. And I said this a minute ago, so it's just him giving me an amen, I guess. The proper function of government is limited only to the spheres of activity within which the individual citizen has the right to act. Okay.
What does that mean? I don't understand.
Great question. Let's be very specific here. And let's be a little controversial, because I like being controversial. My neighbor Bob is a hippie. He's not really, and I don't have a neighbor Bob, but this is an example. My neighbor Bob is a hippie, and he grows marijuana in his basement. Okay? We're still doing our mental exercise. Government doesn't exist. It's like Lord of the Flies. We're just, you know, doing our own thing. Do I have the moral authority as Bob's neighbor to beat him upside the head, to take some of his money, or to lock him in my basement because he's growing marijuana in his basement?
Do you have the moral authority?
Do I have the moral authority to use any form of coercion upon Bob, who hasn't harmed anyone, he hasn't stepped out of his house smoking marijuana, he doesn't have kids, he's not selling it, he doesn't have kids, you know, who's endangering. This is just my hippie neighbor, Bob.
For his own pleasure.
For his own medical marijuana or whatever, right? No!
No, you don't have
to. No!
Right.
There should be, you know, where's the resounding no? This one's easy. Okay, no! Therefore, I cannot delegate to the government the authority to exercise coercion against hippie Bob on my behalf. Therefore, the war on drugs, the entire basis upon which the war on drugs is predicated, is completely illegitimate. Now, I recognize, of course, there are exceptions. If he's dealing drugs to kids, if he's driving under the influence, or there's all sorts of nuances. But, and that's not, let's sidestep that for a minute and deal with the core issue. The core issue is someone who is ingesting a substance into their body that I consider to be a harmful drug that it violates the tenets of my religion. Do I have the authority to impose my disbelief or my prohibition, personal prohibition of that substance? No. Therefore, the government can't do it. So I'm going to read the Benson statement again now that we've given an example, and that'll hopefully clarify. The proper function of government is limited only to the spheres of activity within which the individual citizen has the right to act. The government can only do the things that you and I can do. That's it. So we need to address and understand what you and I can do. And this is something that too many people don't do, and it's the basis of put down the Constitution for a moment, why government begins with you. Because if we're just jumping to the Constitution, which is okay, I mean, I'm not disparaging the Constitution at all here today, but if we jump to the Constitution without addressing and understanding the fundamental nature of what government is and what authority it can derive, then honestly, there's no point to this, because we're arguing about something we don't understand. Yeah?
So if one of the duties of the president is to provide protection for our country, is my understanding.
Okay.
So how does that fit in that? We can also protect our own
country. Absolutely.
So
and that's
the government.
And that's kind of ultimately the basis of what President Benson talks about, or then Elder Benson, in The Proper Role of Government. That the government, when you reduce it to its just and moral powers, is really only the collective organization of self-defense. Because what do you and I, as neighbors on our Lord of the Flies island here, have the right to do to one another? I can't beat you upside the head if you're selling lemonade at a lemonade stand and get my permission, which is what the government tries to do. Yeah, we can't use violence, because government is violence. Government is force, right? We can't use violence against one another for things that we disagree with. Only if you violated my rights can I defend myself against you. That's the only legitimate instance in which I can use violence. Therefore, that is the only legitimate instance in which government can use violence on my behalf. Let me go up to our next point, because I don't want to lose my train of thought. And then, so in The Proper Role of Government, in this lecture by President Benson, he quotes an individual with whom you should all be familiar. And if you're not, go look him up. He's one of my heroes. Frederick Bastiat.
Frederick.
Okay. I'm gonna write his name up here. There's no marker in there. All right, let's do blue. Frederick Bastiat. Yes. So Benson quotes him a lot. I quote him a lot. He's a great guy. I'd love to have lunch with him. Okay, Frederick Bastiat. I got that right. He was a Frenchman. He was in he died in 1850 prematurely. He was a politician, economist. He was basically
economist.
Not a communist. Quite the opposite.
Economist.
Frederick Bastiat. He was in France. He was basically the Thomas Jefferson a few decades later. He wrote this book called The Law. You can find this book online for free as a PDF. You can find an audio version of it for free. And if you sign up that email list in the corner, in about 2 weeks, our organization, Libertas Institute, is going to be doing a brand new printing of it as well. And we'll tell you how you can get a copy if you want. You can sign that email list. That's new and improved and very handsome looking. I went to the printer yesterday and it looked great. So, The Law. Well, why is that important? Bastiat, why is he important? Ezra Taft Benson, in his address of the proper role of government, many times quotes Frederick Bastiat to kind of a second witness for what he's talking about. Bastiat was great at this stuff. He could just drill down to principle and articulate, and that's what he does in this paragraph I'm going to read. So remember, President Benson says, proper function of government is only what you and I can do to one another. So here's Bastiat. He says, it seems to me that the rights of the state, the government, can be nothing but the regularizing of pre-existent personal rights. For my part, I cannot conceive a collective right, a government right, that does not have its foundation in an individual right or presuppose it. Hence, to know whether the state is legitimately invested with a right, we must ask whether the individual has that right in virtue of his nature and in absence of all government. So I'm not the only one that does this mental exercise, right? John Locke did. Frederick Bastiat did, these great thinkers of liberty throughout the centuries. They're saying, look, government is just something you and I construct with one another when we say, let's get together and secure our liberties. But it's something we create. We exist before government. The government doesn't just do what the Constitution says. The government has to do what it is morally and legitimately able to do, and that is to secure our rights and not violate them, and therefore not assume, not steal, not use any authority or invent any authority that you and I don't have, because then we couldn't have delegated it to the government, okay? So, I don't know why I put that in there. Okay, so we're being attacked by an enemy. In the last class, I was talking about how secret combinations are our enemy. The Book of Mormon is quite clear on that. Then there's a book called Awakening to Our Awful Situation that goes into great detail on that. These guys are in the Book of Mormon tried to overtake the government. They were successful. That's how they dismantled all society, and they're doing it again. So we're being attacked by the enemy. The government has been taken over by these guys. Our rights are being violated. The government has exceeded whatever bounds it, in theory, once had. I mean, this is irrelevant in Washington. It holds almost no force. The Constitution is made to be a laughingstock. So should we keep raising the Constitution in the air with a clenched fist, hoping that someone can fix the federal government? Well, the Book of Mormon has, I think, what is the right approach. And that's told in the story of Amalickiah. So Amalickiah was a really scheming individual. And he was a Nephite, right? This wasn't some foreign Lamanite guy. This was a Nephite. He desired to be king. He employed flattery and deceit, and he gained a significant following as a result. He led away the hearts of many people to do wickedly and encouraged his group to destroy the foundation of liberty which God had granted unto them. That's Alma 46:10. So we're all familiar with the counterpart here, Captain Moroni, right? So in response, Captain Moroni, he gets really angry. He tears his coat to pieces. He gets a piece and he writes, "In memory of our God, our religion and freedom and our peace, our wives and our children." Alma 46:12. Calls it the title of liberty. Uses it to rally the Nephites, close ranks against those wishing to attack their religion, their liberty, and their families. Well, throughout all this, Amalickiah worked his way up and became king of the Lamanites, right? Very clever how he did it, actually. It was very, very interesting. And he used this new political position to impose propaganda, to breed animosity amongst the once peaceful Lamanites. These Lamanites, you know, weren't bothering anyone, really, until they got incited to hatred and to war by Amalickiah. So as he prepared a military campaign Alma 48:4, to overpower the Nephites and to bring them into bondage, Moroni was preparing his people, in 48:7, to be faithful unto the Lord their God. By strengthening the weakest fortifications and increasing their defensive barriers, in 48:10, it says, Moroni was preparing to support their liberty, their lands, their wives, their children, and their peace. So these exhaustive efforts Moroni is preparing for his people, they later prove successful in repelling external attacks. Right? Book of Mormon talks about how lots of attacks were thwarted with these defensive barriers that they put up. But what happened? Moroni had to deal with an internal dissension. Right? So there was a land dispute with the people of Morianton. This is Alma 50, 25 to 35. Folks in Morianton, this is over land. Property rights, really, is all they're arguing about. But then there was also dissent by the Kingmen that wanted to alter their form of government. That's Alma 51, 2 through 21. And then other wars and contentions among his own people. This weakened the Nephites' ability to repel the Lamanite attacks. While Moroni was required to focus on cleansing the Nephites' inward vessel, that's Alma 60, 23, the Lamanites invaded a city that was not strong enough to survive the attack, and the rest, as they say, is history. So what happened here? What happened was Moroni, in effect, was waiving the Constitution, waiving his title of liberty, and he was focusing on something at kind of the extremities of their society. He was focusing on the defensive barriers at their outermost part. While at the very core of their society, there were all of these internal problems that were being caused by secret combinations, by the Kingmen, by these folks trying to usurp power, that dismantled it from within.
So and the Morianton and the land dispute, that was a planned thing by the Kingmen?
No, that was one of many influences that combine with the Kingmen, with other wars and contentions is what it says, but they don't go into... Yeah, so there were kind of a combination of things, but these things were all internal. So why are you and I fighting for freedom at the federal level while tolerating and in many cases supporting tyranny here at home? If Moroni's strategy for success was to completely pause his efforts externally, right, with the Lamanites, and leave it behind and go focus on cleansing the inward vessel, why should ours be any different? Why are we holding this up to Congress when we're ignoring or supporting, electing, or, you know, otherwise cheering on big government stuff at home? So my own political progression kind of validates this. 2009, I was very much a kind of guy. And I supported at the time, that sounds bad, but I supported Mike Lee for Senate. And this was the race with Bob Bennett. If you remember, he was the incumbent. The Tea Party was surging. Lots of chatter about the Constitution. I got on very early in Mike's campaign. I was part of his core staff of, you know, seven or eight people or whatever. And I liked what Mike was talking about, because he was going around giving lectures with a group he called the Article I Society, which he derived from Article I of the Constitution about Congress's powers. And he was going around giving lectures on the Constitution. He was actually talking a lot about plenary power along the way, too. And it was good stuff, because we need to fix Congress. The federal government is a joke. They are oppressing us. It is awful. Anything worse than King George was doing. It's just run amok. So my thinking at the time was, we need to get the Mike Lees elected who understand the Constitution, who are going to fight for the Constitution, who are going to support liberty at the federal level. And a book came out. So I was on Mike's campaign through the primary, and then I joined an organization called the 10th Amendment Center. And a book had come out a few months earlier called Nullification by Tom Woods, which I consider, for anyone interested in the Constitution, a must-read. Nullification by Tom Woods. So this book was brand new. It was very radical at the time. Interestingly enough, an Associated Press article came out just this week about nullification, talking about how many states are doing it and how it's this big thing. But in 2010, and even in the years since, it's, oh, this radical thing, slavery, and you want to support, you know, whatever. So nullification was fantastic, because what happened was you had this book that talked about what it is. It documented the history throughout the state legislatures, how they fought for freedom. They didn't fight for freedom by saying, we need to get the congressman elected to go fight for freedom. What they did in their first century and a half of America's existence was empower the state legislatures to do that. The state legislatures were a check on the federal government. It was through the local state legislatures, where you could more easily have influence and get good people involved, that they then fought Congress and were a check and a balance. You go to any social studies class these days, and the checks and the balances they talk about are all federal, right? Congress, You have your legislative, your judiciary, and your executive. Those are supposedly the checks and balances. How's that working out for us?
They just validate
one another's tyranny. That's all they do. So, not all, 95%. So, they leave out this rich portion of our country's history, and that is that the states once were and are starting to now become, again, a check against the federal government. And that is using a tool that may sound radical, but it's not, called nullification. Fascinating book. So Tom Woods, good friend of mine now, documents the history of that, the successes of that, what they used it for. For example, the fugitive slave laws. You had these escaped slaves who were running up to the north, and the laws at the time said that the slaves had to be, if they were captured or found, had to be returned to their rightful owners in the south. Well, you had all these people in the north who used nullification, because this was a federal law, right? And they said, that fugitive slave law is immoral. It lacks this legitimacy of authority that you or I as individuals have. It's unconstitutional. So they nullified it. They said, effectively, it's civil disobedience. We're not going to comply with that. Absolutely not. And they were successful. So he documents lots of stuff like that. So I read this book. I'm 50 pages in, and I'm like, this is amazing. Why have I not heard of this before? So I decide to raise some money to buy a copy of the book for everyone in the Utah legislature, and the governor and the attorney general, because I'm thinking, this is all interesting history to me, but I'm not in the legislature. The people who are in the legislature need to understand that this is how we can, not just, you know, this, but that we can fight through our state legislatures. So we did that project, the Utah Nullification Project, and we got one for all the government officials in Utah. That caught the attention of this national group, fantastic group, called the 10th Amendment Center. And that's all they exist to do, is to work with their state chapters to empower the state legislatures or the state they're in to fight Congress based on the 10th Amendment, which says that any powers not delegated to the federal government are retained by reserved to the states or the people. So that's what the 10th Amendment Center exists to do, is to not waive the Constitution at the congressional level where that's proven highly ineffective, but to work more effectively, have a better return on our investment of time, of money, political capital in the state legislatures, and pass laws that say Congress, you're not allowed to regulate wheat that I grow in my backyard. You're not allowed to regulate industrial hemp, which, you know, Brigham Young and the pioneers loved. It was a fantastic crop. It's not marijuana. You can't smoke it. And yet now the federal government prohibits it. And we have to import it. And they radiate it and all this other stuff. Anyways, so the 10th Amendment Center works with these states. And that was my thinking had changed. Whereas before I was saying, we need the Mike Lees and those in Congress, I had kind of shifted and said, well, that's all well and good, and that's not to say we shouldn't, but I can be so much more effective at the state level. So I became director of the Utah 10th Amendment Center and worked with these legislators to fight back against the feds. And if you go back and look at some of the news stories and stuff during 2010, you'll see that we had several nullification bills. We had a lot of news generated. We had a lot of interest. We had a lot of discussion that was generated about this stuff. It was great. We were doing a good job. But I ran into a problem. My teaser. I say I ran into a problem and then I make you wait while I sip a drink. What's the problem? Problem was I would join arms with these legislators and kind of shake our fist at the federal government and say, you shouldn't be doing that. Let us do this, right? Join arms with these legislators. We'd be nullifying or trying to. And then we'd get done with that bill or whatever. And then these guys would turn around here in Utah and impose the same kind of stuff in the state that they were fighting at the federal level. So they were for small government, limited government at the federal level, but they were for big government at the state level. Well, why is that? I think it's just our susceptibility for not having a benchmark to look at. These legislators, state legislators, didn't have a benchmark. They bought into the plenary power thing. They thought they were omnipotent. They thought the Utah government, unless it's prohibited from doing so, can do whatever it wants, which is a fundamental violation of what government is in the first place. So that's when I quit the 10th Amendment Center, not because it's a bad organization. It's a fantastic organization. Their website is 10thamendmentcenter.com. They have all sorts of great articles and resources. Great, great, great group. But I realized that wasn't where I needed to be. And in fact, we talked about Captain Moroni cleansing the inward vessel. This is the scripture that was perpetually in my mind in these weeks and months as I'm kind of dealing with this and figuring out what to do. So then I said, you know what? I need to just do my own thing. So that's when we started Libertas Institute. So with Libertas Institute, we're focused entirely on the state of Utah. Because too often we get people, whether because of, you know, prophetic instruction to support the Constitution, which I'm not knocking at all, or a cultural thing, you know, Glenn Beck and others are trying to push us to fight what Congress is up to, which is we need to fight it, and that's great. But everyone oversteps the state, and they don't focus on what's going on here in Utah. And they overlook or support big government. So that's what we started Libertas Institute for that. And the reason why is ultimately with those laws that I read in the beginning, those are all Utah laws. I kind of had some easy ones in there. I mean, the bath salts, you know, there's a lot of news about that being from Utah. The Zion's Curtain, like they call it, for restaurants, they have to build the barrier to mix alcohol drinks. That's a Utah thing. So some of these are probably easy maybe for you to pick up that they're Utah things. But there are many more like them that violate this fundamental concept of what government is and what with what power it can operate. So we need a benchmark, right? We have one for the federal government. We need one for the state. What is it? How do we know what the state should be doing? So the Constitution, the benchmark for the federal level, it's great to point to it and read Article 1, Section 8, but like we said, the federal government might do things that it's permitted to do based on the text of the Constitution, but when it says that we want to invade Mexico or even invade Burma, like, you know, someone who hasn't attacked us, well, okay, if it declares war, it's authorized, right? But is it the right thing? So what's that benchmark? What's the benchmark of principle? What's the benchmark of moral authority that we need to be looking at? There's a 1901 Supreme Court case called, I don't know if anyone will want to look this up, but just in case, Codding versus Goddard. And he gives a hint. The unanimous Supreme Court case, I should say they, the justices, give a hint. And this case is actually quite irrelevant. It's kind of a silly little, case that wasn't anything significant, but the ruling that came out of it had such an amazing nugget that I'm going to read now that addresses the point that I'm asking. And again, that is, even though something is authorized by the U.S. Constitution, our benchmark, does that make it right? Or is there another benchmark for principle, for moral authority that we need to talk about? This is what it says. The first official action of this nation declared the foundation of government in these words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. While such a declaration of principles may not have the force of organic law, or be made the basis of judicial decision, again, I'll summarize this at the end if it's confusing, or be made the basis of judicial decision as to the limits of right and duty, and while in all cases reference must be had to the organic law of the nation for such limits, yet the latter, he's talking about the Constitution now, the Constitution is but the body and the letter of which the former, the Declaration of Independence, is the thought and the spirit. I'll paraphrase this because it's a little confusing. And it is always safe to read the letter of the Constitution in the spirit of the Declaration of Independence. No duty rests more imperatively upon the courts, the court system, than the enforcement of those constitutional provisions intended to secure that equality of rights which is the foundation of free government. Okay, what does that all mean? That's for the non-lawyer speak. What that means is this. It is insufficient to point to this for authority of any government action. It's not wrong to do so, it's insufficient to do so, because the Constitution was meant to embody the principles of the Declaration of Independence. That makes sense? So we look to this for the letter of the law. What he's saying is a judge can't say, well, this violates Declaration of Independence sentence 2, where it says we're supposed to support life, liberty, and property. No, that's not how the courts work. They go based on the law that created the courts to begin with. That's the Constitution. So he's saying we don't point to the Declaration to invalidate a law. We look to the Declaration for interpretation of what the Constitution is allowed to authorize. And what that means is, with my example in Burma, well, okay, Congress is allowed legislatively, constitutionally, to declare war on Burma for no reason at all. But you have to tie that back to the principles of the Declaration of Independence. And then you'll see that declaring war on Burma is completely illegitimate and should be struck down and opposed. Does that make sense? So the Declaration of Independence becomes our benchmark. Well, the Declaration of Independence isn't just for the federal government. It isn't just for Americans. You go read it, and it's universal. It's all mankind. We all have rights. God, our Creator, has invested us all with these rights. This isn't just for Americans. And that is a much overlooked point as well. So it's for city councils, it's for county commissions, it's for state governments, it's for the federal government. The Declaration of Independence, the ideas contained in there, are the basis of authority for any government action. Thomas Jefferson, interestingly enough, when you go back and look at what he explained about the Declaration of Independence, it was thought to be this radical document, and that's kind of how it's taught to us today, that it's just this, it just came out of thin air, and look, they just kind of champion their rights, and that's not true. What he said 50 years after the fact, he says, it was intended to be an expression of the American mind. And what he meant by that, what he was explaining, was that Americans at the time understood that. That's all he was saying, that it wasn't radical for them. When he created the Declaration of Independence, this is something that Americans, by and large, of course not all of them, innately understood. This is something that was non-controversial, ultimately, in America. In fact, if you go back, and I'll talk about my books here in a minute, in one of my books I document some of these. If you look at the state constitutions and the resolutions that they were doing leading up to the Revolutionary War, some of the official government statements that they were doing, they use some of this exact same language from the Declaration of Independence. They begin to affirm their rights. That John Locke quote I read earlier, he was kind of like their Bible, you know, some of these ideas. And so that's what we need to return to. Because if we're just holding up the Constitution and saying, well, this violates this clause right here, well, okay, legislatively, constitutionally, but what about fundamentally? What about morally? And that is understanding the Declaration of Independence. That is understanding Frederick Bastiat and what he was talking about. That's understanding John Locke. What is the underlying basis? We got rid of the Constitution, got rid of the federal government. Then we understand what authority the government can even have to begin with. So that's what we need to return to, is this is popularized understanding. So our political fight, I think, needs to be educational and not constitutional. Because if we lack the former, I always get my formers and my ladders mixed up, right? If we're not educated on the principles underlying the Constitution, we're going to be doing a disservice. We're not going to be effective. And I'm almost done, and then we can do any questions that you have. So remember what Ezra Taft Benson said. The proper function of government is limited only to the spheres of activity within which the individual citizen has the right to act. In the law, this is how Bastiat explains it. Unfortunately, law by no means confines itself to its proper functions. That makes sense, right? I mean, we talk about the Constitution, but the government doesn't obey this. The law doesn't confine itself to its proper functions. When it has exceeded its proper functions, it has not done so merely in some inconsequential and debatable matters. The law has gone further than this. It has acted in direct opposition to its own purpose. The law has been used to destroy its own objective. It has been applied to annihilating the justice that it was supposed to maintain, to limiting and destroying rights, which its real purpose was to respect. The law has placed the collective force, government, at the disposal of the unscrupulous who wish, without risk, to exploit the person, liberty, and property of others. It has converted plunder into a right. If that feels potent to you, this whole book is like that. And it's not a long book, but you just read it, and mine is like, my other one is underlined like crazy. It's fantastic. Because you realize that that's exactly what's happened today. Right? Government exists to secure rights, and it violates it. Government exists to uphold justice, and it's imposing injustice. Government exists to serve the people. Look at the NSA scandal. That's not at all what it's doing, right? So he talks about back in 1850, 49, when he wrote this, that it was happening then. It happened in the Book of Mormon. This isn't just a last days kind of thing. So leading towards closing, here's a quote from Ezra Taft Benson, 1986. All is not well in Zion. We must cleanse the inner vessel, beginning first with ourselves, then with our families, and finally with the church. So he's talking about in a religious and a church context, it applies just as much with political. Notice that he said in order, right? I'll read it again. All is not well in Zion. We must cleanse the inner vessel, beginning first with ourselves, then with our families, and finally with the church. That is why the title, I don't know if it's controversial or not, but good government begins with you. We need to set aside the Captain Moroni fighting the Lamanites on the borders. And while that's still important, we still need defensive protection. He forgot to pay attention to what was happening at home that caused a lot of trouble for him, right? We need to focus first on ourselves, as Ezra Taft Benson says, and our family, finally, he says, with the church. But that same progression happens. We need to understand these principles so that we can then apply them to our city councils, to our state legislature, to our federal government. Because if we jump steps and land at the federal government and start shaking our fist, well, okay, are you going to be effective? Are you going to recognize when the federal government is doing something that's unconstitutional, but maybe you like it and you've been brought up to think that it is constitutional because you don't understand the underlying principle? When government does something that, remember Amalickiah with all his propaganda, right? And he persuaded all these Lamanites to buy into his message that these Nephites were these awful people that needed to be destroyed. Are you going to be able to counteract that propaganda and recognize it for what it is, or are you going to be swayed away, right? Are you going to understand that even if something is constitutional, it might not be moral? That this isn't our only benchmark, nor should it be. There's something far more fundamental that we should first turn to, and that is these ideas. So in closing, I'll do questions in a minute, but let me...
It's still important. It's an important part of our country, is that constitutional?
Absolutely. And like I said at the beginning, I'm not here to minimize its importance. I'm not here to disparage it. My only emphasis here, my takeaway, is that there are a lot of steps that we each need to do educationally before we start getting so heavily focused on this. And far too few people do that. Okay, so I've got two books. I'm not a sales guy. Don't buy them if you don't want them. Couldn't care less. Well, I do care. I want you to read them because I think the message they have is important. But everything that I'm talking about is summed up in this first book. Not summed up. It's expounded, I guess you can say. Latter-day Liberty is my take on what the gospel of Jesus Christ has to say about government and politics. My own political progression, I gave a little bit with the Mike Lee and the 10th Amendment Center and now Libertas Institute, but along the way and even in years before that, I would read scriptures here, maybe an Ezra Taft Benson quote here, maybe a Joseph Smith quote here. My education was very fragmented in how I came to understand, as I understand now, liberty. And along the way, I would get people asking me and say, well, what can I read or what can I give my son or, you know, whatever, point me. And I'm like, I don't know. It was like 4 million different places. So that's why I wrote the book. First half of the book is an understanding of what the gospel has to say about liberty. What is liberty? How does the war on heaven apply? How does agency apply? How does the Constitution apply? What does all of this mean for a gospel contextualized definition of liberty? Not the Republican Party version, not the conservative version, not the, interestingly enough, as I explained the first chapter, Mormons were by and large Democrats in their earlier days. We are mostly Republicans now, but back then it was completely flipped. So interesting story there. It's not about parties. It's about principle. It's about this moral underpinning of exactly what we're talking about this benchmark needs to be. So that's the first half of the book. But then I say, well, it's important to understand all that, but if we're still at 10,000 feet and it's all just superficial and in theory, how are we going to actually apply it? So the second half of the book is where I have some fun and get a little controversial, and that is to choose a few political topics about which there is disagreement, sometimes significant disagreement, even within the church. If I can find my table of contents, then I'll tell you. Maybe I can't find it. There we go.
Do you have reference to that talk?
So I quote this talk in here several times, absolutely. This is all, and when I say the gospel version of what liberty is, you know, using all sorts of scriptures and general authority quotes and all that. So in the second half I say, well, we understand liberty, but if we're going to really have this benchmark be successful, we need to actually see how it can be applied. So that's in the second half of the book. I talk about war, right? I mentioned that a little bit. Immigration, another hot topic right now, right? Education, the war on drugs, welfare. So giving specific examples of what the gospel might have to say about these specific issues that we superficially overlook. Second book is Latter-day Responsibility, and that is, there's a quote that says, liberty means responsibility, that's why most men dread it. Maybe you've heard of that quote, it's kind of famous. Liberty means responsibility, that's why most men dread it. And so the basis of the second book is to say, it's all well and good to talk about liberty and everything I'm talking about today, but if we're not living our lives in such a way as to be affirming and implementing our personal responsibilities, this is all just chatter, right? I mean, we're not going to be free. We're not actually going to have liberty. So in this book, every chapter is a different responsibility that we need to fulfill. For example, self-defense, financial freedom, staying out of bondage, of debt, welfare and charity, taking care of one another rather than the government doing that on our behalf and at the expense of our liberty. Preparedness and self-reliance. We don't need FEMA. We need one another. Education, doing our civic duty, producing our own food, strong families, faith and morality. So these are all the different responsibilities that we each need to live to actually have anything that I talk about today have any actual application and relevance in our lives.